Arthur Machen once wrote that strange things are lost and forgotten in obscure corners of the newspaper. This podcast will aim to prove that that statement is true.
Hello, and welcome to the fourth episode of Forgotten Darkness. I'm Andrew Gable. This week, we'll leave the United States for a story from overseas. Ireland, to be exact. Of all unexplained phenomena, one in which I've developed a strong interest in the past few years are poltergeists. Those ghosts that, popularly anyway, I'm not really convinced they have much to do with ghostly phenomena, but those spirits that throw items around, knock on walls, sometimes start fires, and seem fond of making it rain stones. These are only some of the more common activities of poltergeists, though by no means are they the only ones. I might revisit poltergeists at some point in the future in their own episode. I probably more than likely will, actually. The case, though, that we'll be discussing here has some uncommon attributes, namely the ability of the entity to speak, and also to appear as an animal of some type. Usually these are things like rabbits or weasels, but in this case it's not. At the base of Montpelier Hill, the Steward's House is a long hall type house located along the R115 or Killickey Road, a few miles south of Dublin. The building is often called Killickey House, though that name properly belonged to a house to the east that was demolished in 1941. The ruins of that house are today usually known as Lord Massey's estate. The Killickey area, which name, by the way, derives from the Irish Cui an Chuaigh, or Wood of the Blind Man, and there's my attempt to pronounce Gaelic. Please don't hate me too bad. Has its share of connections to the Irish Revolutionary Movement. A commonly heard story in connection with the area is that Irish Revolutionary leader and Sinn Féin member Constance de Markievicz took up residence in Killickey House during the 1916 Revolution, though which one is meant isn't really clear to me. I assume that it probably meant the ruined estate, because that is the building that was called Killickey House at the time. Though there's still like many people who claim that it is the Steward's House. So, I don't know. There was also a gunfight between the Royal Irish Constabulary Special Reserve, popularly known as the Black and Tans, and the Irish Republican Army, or IRA, which resulted in 5 deaths at the Steward House in the 1920s. And in 1930, officers of the Garda, or Irish police, were encamped at the Massey estate while they were searching for explosives that the IRA had hidden somewhere in the area. Well, anyway, in the 1920s, the Massey family fortunes had begun to decline, and they took residence for a time in the Steward's House before they took more permanent residence at another house in the area. Following this, the Steward's House had apparently sat vacant for many years until it was purchased in 1968 by Nicholas and Margaret O'Brien, who had plans to renovate the structure and turn it into an artist center. They were the ones who actually renamed it Killickey House. Several workmen resident in the house had heard growling sounds in the yard of the home at night, to the extent that eventually Margaret had to meet with a lead painter, which was Tom McCassie, although some accounts give him use the last name Massey, like the former Lords of Killickey, though McCassie seems to be the correct name, about the animalistic noises. Several workmen had left the job already, and eager to keep the renovation on schedule, she decided that she'd stay at the house overnight to see for herself whether there were animal prowlers around. And that night, as she was heading into her bedroom, she claimed to have seen a large black cat squatting in the middle of the hallway, glaring at her with a kind of eerie intelligence. She moved away back down the hall, and when she turned around, the cat had vanished. And soon afterward, Tom McCassie himself was to see the black cat. Together with 2 other workmen, He noticed that the front door was unlocked, although it had been locked only a moment before. Taking a look outside, McCassie noticed a large black cat lying in the courtyard outside, a cat which spoke to him. "You don't see me," it said. Upon which, apparently, McCassie thought to himself that that sounded about right, and moved to close the door and relock it. "Leave this door open," the cat said in response. This was to prove the most famous encounter in the house, because McCassie was to paint a picture of the eerie, baleful-eyed cat with a strangely human face that he saw. Another version of the account says that it was a ghostly figure in the courtyard which spoke to McCassie and then came inside and then changed into a cat. Poltergeist-like phenomena had also begun to occur in the house, with doors slamming, there were more growls and animalistic sounds being heard, and sometimes there was a sound of tinkling bells. Margaret called in an exorcist to drive out whatever ghosts inhabited the place, and unlike usually, it actually seems to have been successful. However, a year later, there were some guests that held a seance in the house, and the ghostly manifestations began again. The cat began to appear again, and now it was joined by two human apparitions. A television documentary filmed on the premises featured a medium who claimed to be in contact with the spirits, who she claimed were women that had participated in rituals performed by the Hellfire Club. And in 1971, a small child skeleton was discovered buried in the home. After this, Margaret again had another exorcist in the house, and this caused the manifestations to cease again. To the current time, no other manifestations are known to have occurred in the house, and it's now a private residence. The psychic who came into the house in 1970 alluded to the Hellfire Club. The Hellfire Club was technically plural, not really a singular entity. The earliest one was founded in 1718 by Lord Philip Wharton. Wharton, though a respected politician, had a reputation for being, quote, a drunkard, a rioter, an infidel, and a rake, unquote. His Hellfire Club was essentially a drinking society with a little veneer of Satanism on top of it. The president of the club was supposed to be the devil, and the members started calling themselves devils. They performed mock religious ceremonies, and likewise during their club dinners, they ate dishes with names like Holy Ghost Pie or Devil's Loin. Eventually, Wharton's political enemies helped put an end to his activities, pressuring the king to pass a bill directed at the hard impieties, which was really a veiled attack on the Hellfire Club. The most famous Hellfire Club, ironically, never even actually had that name. In 1746, Sir Francis Dashwood founded the Order of the Friars or Knights of St. Francis, or the Order of the Knights of West Wycombe. That's usually what he referred to it as. Years later, afterwards, it started being referred to as the Hellfire Club, though it was never actually called the Hellfire Club. The Knights of West Wycombe was, there were caves that Dashwood excavated under the English town of West Wycombe, and those caves are today known as the Hellfire Caves, and they're a popular spot for paranormal investigations. While Wharton's Hellfire Club was more of a drinking society with a little veneer of blasphemy, the Knights of West Wycombe are rumored to have actually engaged in black magic and Satanism, in addition to copious drinking and debauchery. The truth of what really went on isn't really known, though. At any rate, Dashwood's group had dissolved by 1766. The Hellfire Club that the psychic referred to, though, was founded in 1735 by Richard Parsons, who was the first Earl of Ross. He was, quote, a sorcerer, dabbler in black magic, and a man of humor and frolic, unquote. The club's normal meeting place was the Eagle Tavern on Cork Hill in Dublin proper. Peter Somerville Large writes in Irish Eccentrics that popular supposition associates them with the gaunt ruin on top of Montpelier Hill, and the odd black mass have taken place in Mr. Connolly's airy hunting lodge. The lodge to which he refers was built by William Connolly. It's a somewhat eerie-looking structure. Legend has it that the building had been cursed from the time it was constructed. Some stones from an ancient cairn on the hill had been used in the fireplace. Weston St. John Joyce wrote, "Shortly after the house was built, the slated roof was blown off one night in a tremendous storm. By the agency of the devil, it was popularly believed, on account of the sacrilegious conduct of the builder in desecrating the old cairn. But Squire Connolly was not a man to be easily beaten, and so he set to work and built a massive arched roof of stones, keyed together as if in a bridge, and of such impregnable strength that it has effectually withstood the efforts of wind or devil, whichever it was, from that day to this." Connolly died in 1729 before he put the lodge to much use, and it was leased by the Hellfire Club. Now, ironically, Montpelier Hill itself actually sat on land that was once owned by Lord Wharton, the founder of the first Hellfire Club. Now, in reality, it's not clear whether the lodge was really even used that much by the club. After all, as I said earlier, the club normally met at the Eagle Tavern in Dublin. However, they've certainly become associated with the building and popular culture. One of the tales associated with the lodge is a familiar folkloric trope. The tale tells of a stranger who arrived at the lodge and joined a card game. At some point, one of the other players became aware that the stranger had a cloven hoof and realized they were playing cards with the devil. The same story, though, is usually associated with another Irish landmark, Loftus Hall, in County Wexford. It's a familiar folkloric tale, but I also wonder if there was some confusion, given the fact that the same Loftus family also did own a home on Montpelier Hill. At some point, the lodge was partially burnt. There are several tales meant to explain this. One is that it was set on fire by the club when William Connolly's son refused to renew the lease. Another states that it was done to give the lodge a more hellish appearance. And yet another centers on one of the most notorious members of the club, a Richard Chapel Whaley, who was charmingly known as Burn Chapel to his friends. He received this nickname due to his charming habit of setting church roofs on fire when he was drunk. This tale claimed that during one of the black masses that they held there, a drink was spilled on Whaley's coat, and Whaley responded by, as you would, by pouring brandy on the man and setting him on fire. Yeah, sounds normal to me. Whatever the case, the Hellfire Club met for a time in the steward's house after the fire. Shortly thereafter, the club was disbanded. This likely places these events around 1741, which was the year of Richard Parsons' death. In 1771, it was revived under Thomas Whaley, who was the son of Burn Chapel, and was active until his death in 1800. The devil, or at least some demon, taking the form of a cat, is a common feature of many old legends. Witches were often reputed to be able to shape-shift into the forms of cats and other animals. Their familiars often assumed the forms of cats or dogs, and at least some believed that the Scottish rite of Togarm, at least one depraved version of it, which involved burning cats alive, could summon a giant demonic cat which would function like an oracle, and it would, like, answer questions that you asked of it. Now, interestingly, given some of the associations discussed in this episode between, like, fire and burning and the black cat of Killochee, the demon Flauros, who had command of fire, was usually pictured as a cat-like man. But anyway, England, 1566. A witch trial took place in Chelmsford, Essex, northeast of London. The accused were three women from the nearby village of Hatfield Peveril: Elizabeth Francis, her sister Agnes Waterhouse, and Agnes's daughter, Joan Waterhouse. First, Elizabeth was questioned. She learned this art of witchcraft at the age of 12 years of her grandmother, whose name was Eve of Hatfield Peverell, deceased. When she taught it to her, she counseled her to renounce God and his word and to give of her blood to Satan, as she termed it, which she delivered her in the likeness of a white spotted cat, and taught her to feed the said cat with bread and milk, and she did so. Also, she taught her to call it by the name of Satan and keep it in a basket. When this Mother Eve had given her the cat Satan, then this Elizabeth desired first of the said cat, calling it Satan, that she might be rich and have goods, and he promised her that she should. Asking her what she would have, she said sheep, for this cat spake to her as she confessed in a strange hollow voice, and this cat forthwith brought sheep into her pasture to the number of 28 black and white, which continued with her for a time, but in the end all did wear away, she knew not how. When she had gotten these sheep, she desired to have one Andrew Biles to be her husband, which was a man of some wealth, and this cat did promise that she should, but said she must first consent this Andrew could abuse her, and so she did. After, when this Andrew had thus abused her, he would not marry her, wherefore she willed Satan to waste his goods, which she forthwith did, and not being contented with this, she willed him to touch his body, which he forthwith did, wherefore he died. Every time that she did anything for her, she said that he required a drop of blood, which she gave him by pricking herself, sometime in one place and then in another, and where she pricked herself, there remained a red spot which was still to be seen. When this Andrew was dead, she, fearing herself with child, unintelligible with Satan, to destroy it, and he had her take a certain herb and drink, which she did, and destroyed the child forthwith. When she desired another husband, he promised her another, naming this Francis, whom she now hath, but said he is not so rich as the other, willing her to consent unto that Francis in fornication, which she did, and thereof conceived a daughter that was born within a quarter of a year after they were married. After they were married, they lived not so quietly as she desired, being stirred, as she said, to much unquietness, and moved to swearing and cursing. Wherefore she willed Satan, her cat, to kill the child, being about the age of half a year old, and he did so. And when she found not the quietness that she desired, she willed it to lay a lameness in the leg of this Francis, her husband, and it did it in this manner. It came in a morning to this Francis's shoe, lying in it like a toad, and when he perceived it putting on his shoe, and had touched it with his foot, he, being suddenly amazed, asked her of what it was, and she bade him kill it, and he was forthwith taken with a lameness whereof he cannot be healed. After all this, when she had kept this cat by the space of 15 or 16 years, and as some say, though untruly, being weary of it, she came to one Mother Waterhouse, her neighbor, a poor woman, when she was going to the oven, and desired to give her a cake, and she would give her a thing that she should be the better for, so long as she lived. And this Mother Waterhouse gave her a cake, whereupon she brought her this cat in her apron, and taught her as she was instructed before by her grandmother Eve, telling her that she must call him Satan and give him of her blood and bread and milk as before, and at this examination would confess no more. Agnes continued the tale in her testimony. When she had received him, she, to try him to see what he could do, willed him to kill a hog of her own, which he did, and she gave him for his labor a chicken, which she first required of her in a drop of her blood. And this she gave him at all times when he did anything for her, by pricking her hand or face and putting the blood to his mouth, which he sucked, and forthwith would lie down in his pot again, wherein she kept him, the spots of all the witch pricks are yet to be seen in her skin. Also she saith that another time, being offended with one Father Kersey, she took her cat Satan in her lap, and put him in the wood before her door, and willed him to kill three of this Father Kersey's hogs, which he did, and returning again told her so, and she rewarded him, as before, with a chicken and a drop of her blood, which chicken he ate up clean as he did all the rest, and she could find remaining neither bones nor feathers. Also, she confessed that falling out with one Widow Goday, she willed Satan to drown her cow, and he did so, and she rewarded him as before. Also, she falling out with another of her neighbors, she killed her 3 geese in a similar manner. She confessed that because she could have no rest, which she required, she caused Satan to destroy the brewing at that time. Also, being denied butter of another, she caused her to lose the curds 2 or 3 days after. Falling out with another of her neighbors and his wife, she willed Satan to kill him with a bloody slice, whereof he died, and she rewarded him as before. Likewise, she confessed that because she lived somewhat unquietly with her husband, she caused Satan to kill him, and he did so about 9 years past, since which time she hath lived a widow. This Mother Waterhouse confessed that she first turned this cat into a toad by this means. She kept the cat a great while in wool in a pot, and at length being moved by poverty to occupy the wool, she praised in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost that it would turn into a toad, and forthwith it was turned into a toad, and so kept it in the pot without wool. That section referring to praying in Latin, according to other sources, she had to pray in Latin because the cat forbade her from praying in English. Finally, Agnes's 18-year-old daughter, Joan, was also questioned. First, that her mother this last winter would have learned her this art, but she learned it not, neither yet the name of the thing. She saith she never saw it but once in her mother's hand, and that was in the likeness of a toad, and at that time, coming in at a sudden, when her mother called it out to work something withal, she heard her call it Satan, for she was not at any time truly taught it, nor did ever exercise it before this time as followeth. She confessed that when her mother was gone to Breakstead, in her absence lacking bread, she went to a girl, a neighbor's child, and desired her to give her a piece of bread and cheese, which when she denied and gave her not, or at least not so much as would satisfy her, she going home did as she had seen her mother do, calling Satan, which came to her, as she said, she thought out of her mother's shawl from under the bed, in the likeness of a great dog, demanding what she would have, wherewithal she being afeard, said she would have him make such a girl afeard, naming this girl. Then he asked her what she would give him, and she said a red cock. Then he said no, but thou shalt give me thy body and soul. Whereby she being sore feared and desirous to be rid of him, said she would. And herewith he went to this girl in the likeness of an evil favored dog with horns on his head, and made her very much afeard, and doth yet haunt her. The girl Joan Waterhouse had cursed, Agnes Brown, was also questioned. She said that Satan had come to her in the shape of a black dog with an ape's face. Well, seemingly mollified somewhat by the fact that she gave him bread, and then the dog came back a week later with a knife in its mouth. The dog, quote, asked me if I were not dead, and I said no, thank God. Then he said if I would not die, he would thrust his knife into my heart, unquote. She later got him to indicate the house of his mistress, and that, of course, was the house of Agnes Waterhouse. And so it was that on July 29th, 1566, Agnes Waterhouse became the first woman in England hanged as a witch. Now, Elizabeth Francis was actually to be hanged also in 1579, because she actually ended up getting caught up in another witch trial and didn't make it out of this one. And that's the end of this episode. A list of sources consulted for this episode can be found in the show description. If you have a question, a comment, or know a lesser-known story that you'd like to see covered, leave a comment on the podcast page, post it to our Facebook page at Forgotten Darkness Podcast, or send it to our email at forgottendarkness77fd@gmail.com. And so, until next episode, this is Andrew, signing off.